Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Amnesia is a common plot device in soap operas. A simple concussion and your identity leaves you. You wander around, unable to find your place in the world. The lack of identity closes some doors but may open others. For my guest on Focus today, actually suffering amnesia was much more complicated than the soap opera variety. David Stewart McLean's amnesia was triggered by a bad reaction of medication and came with many other complications. But it did give the Chicago writer the opportunity, welcome or not, to ponder the question of who he really is. You may have caught David McLean's essay on the subject a few years ago on This American Life. Now David Stewart McLean expands on the subject in his new book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, A Memoir of Amnesia. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And David McLean is on the phone with us from Chicago. David, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim. I'm excited to be here.
Now tell me, David, the experience you went through after reading the book, it just seems horrifying. You started out by finding yourself on a train platform, knowing essentially nothing about where or who you were. Can you bring us back to that moment?
Yeah, it was October 17th, 2002, not that I would have known at the time that's what the date was. But I woke up on the train platform, and I remember this incredibly clearly, more clearly than what I had for dinner last night. I remember waking up and just being empty and having no idea who I was or why I was there. And it was just, at first, I got to say, it wasn't that bad. Because at first, I didn't know that it was supposed to be bad. And then when I realized I didn't really know what my name was, where I was going, what was going to happen next, that's when it was terrifying.
Now, when you said that you woke up, do you mean that you had been, say, lying down and sleeping, or that you just suddenly came to yourself?
I suddenly came to myself. I was standing up when it happened.
Okay. By the way, we welcome your questions on Focus and your comments. And if you have ever suffered from amnesia or known someone who has, please share your experiences with us. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email your questions for David at will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. So you weren't initially frightened or panicky. It just took you a while to figure out that things were wrong.
Right.
What do you do in a situation like that to cope?
That's a good question. I think the first thing I tried to do was I saw a monitor hanging from the rafters, and so I went to the monitor. It was a detail about, like, the train's comings and goings. So I went to the monitor to sort of look, stare at the monitor, and see where I was. But the problem with where I was in India, it's primarily Telugu, Hindi, speaking area. And so the monitor would cycle through the different languages. And so when I first got to the monitor, I couldn't read it. And then I was terrified that I didn't know how to read. And then I was terrified that I didn't have any language. And then the monitor cycled, and then I saw the English translation, and I was so happy. But then I started looking at the train names, and the train names told me nothing.
And it to an extent also, it's not only that you didn't know where you were, you didn't know, it's like you didn't know what you did and did not know. You were still sorting out what knowledge you still had.
Right. That was that's the thing, and it's the problem with memory loss, especially years later after memory loss, is that it's hard to know what you don't know until you're confronted with it. And since I don't live in my hometown, since I don't come across a lot of the people I grew up with, it's hard for me to know what I don't know about myself. And I moved around a lot, so it was hard because I didn't have an immediate sort of social network who could bring me up to speed real fast.
Mm-hmm. And you write in the book about how the police found you, and they seem to be doing their best to help, but they initially thought you were a drug user on a bad trip, and since they believed it, you believed it too.
Yep.
You even came up with false memories to fit this.
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's amazing what the brain does. Like, I really was convinced that, and I even came up with, like, a friend, a woman friend who I was doing drugs with, and her name was Christina. And so Christina and I, prompted only by the police officer saying, like, he'd dealt with drug users before, prompted only by that, I came up with a whole identity as a drug user, doing drugs with a very ugly woman named Christina.
Wow. But there is no Christina.
There is no Christina.
Okay. You will find out later that what actually happened is that you were in India studying on a Fulbright scholarship and you had taken the anti-malarial drug Larium, that's the brand name, which has been known to have side effects, but you had a particularly bad reaction.
Yeah.
And I was interested in reading articles and just listings of side effects. I have here from, I think, one from an internet site called the RX List, and it talks about things that Larium can do. It doesn't mention amnesia. It mentions depressed mood, confusion, extreme fear, hallucination, unusual thoughts, but no amnesia.
Huh. That's interesting, because there's a table in my book from a... an Amsterdam study that includes it. And that it's what it is, it's like you can have paranoia, psychotic breaks, suicide, and it's weird to take a drug whose side effect is suicide. That seems to be a very odd... but... Yeah, I'm sorry, let me find that in my book, but it is a sort of known side effect of this drug.
But not a common one, I take it.
Definitely not a common one.
Okay, let me take a caller here, and this is a line 4 in Charleston, Damon in Charleston. Good morning, you're on Focus.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
I'm really excited to talk to someone who's suffered through, experienced this before. Mainly I know this just through textbooks and class, so it's exciting to ask a question of a real person, but it sounded like the way you talk, you lost your episodic memory, the memories for your own life with you centered, but you still have semantic memories, those memories for, let's say, English and facts.
Yep.
But those are both part of the explicit memory, which I would assume would have been affected. So have you ever had a diagnosis that identifies which part of the memory systems were affected to allow you the abilities that you still retain?
No, that's interesting. No, I've never actually had that. Mostly because when I came back from it, when I came back from India, one of my first goals was to convince everyone that nothing had happened. And so I refused pretty much any treatment. And I refused to act like I had any issues. But the difference, it's funny because, like, there's the difference between the experience of the disease and the diagnosis. And for me, there are parts of this experience that I remember, and I remember knowing who I was. And so it was almost like my brain was spasming in relationship to the drug. And sometimes I would lose everything, and sometimes I would come back. And sometimes I would lose everything, and then sometimes I would come back. And it was like this, it was like almost like a fugue state.
Damon, thank you very much for the call. David, I'm wondering, you know, you were under the effects of the Larium. You suffered from amnesia, but you also suffered from many of the other symptoms, it seemed like, the hallucinations, the strange thoughts, etc. And the narrative that you have in your book is, I think, you know, very subjective. And I get the idea that even after you came to yourself on that train platform throughout the next few weeks when you were in hospitals, I think some things are just lost for you.
Right.
And I gather from reading later in the book that you may have been in more than one hospital and not really have been aware of the change, or at least not remembered the change.
Yeah, one of the great things about having a mother who's a hoarder is she kept every scrap of paper from that time.
Many of which, there are lots of little bits of forms and paperwork reprinted in the book.
Yeah. I use that in the book to sort of like underscore the objective world and then the subjective world that I was going through. So while I'm hallucinating and hanging out with Jim Henson, who's my image of God, like you can see what drugs they had injected me with and what the ambulance cost.
So also, it may not have been just the larium itself and its side effects, but other drugs that they were using to calm you down.
It was definitely the larium that was that had caused the hallucinations. And then the drugs just sort of knocked me out, so I wasn't punching nurses anymore.
That, and you do write of a particular incident in which that did happen.
Yeah. Yeah. That was awful.
Once you got home, you wanted to get home. You wanted to start things back up again. You wanted to go back on your studies in India, and you did that. Instead of thinking that, well, maybe I really need to take a long rest and get this stuff out of my system. One thing I was struck by is you going back and looking at your original proposal and just not understanding it. It was like some knowledge you had acquired in the last few years academically had been erased.
Yeah.
But you did go back, and it sounds like you did the work.
Oh, I didn't really do the work. I will say that. I didn't really do the work. Instead, like I did a couple of interviews. So my proposal was, I was a fiction writer studying fiction at New Mexico State University. And my proposal was to go over to India. And what I was frustrated with was the way Indian characters who spoke in English novels in America were so stereotyped and cliche. I just felt like the voices were never really honest in some ways, that they just felt like they felt like racist stereotypes. And so what I wanted to do was go over to India and study the different languages that people knew. So, like, in where I was in Hyderabad, like, people knew Telugu, some Tamil, and some Hindi. And so, like, it's interesting to think about how those grammatical structures then inflect the way that person constructs sentences in English. And that's what I was really going to do, is to do a bunch of open-ended interviews, and then have those voices on tape, and think about those grammatical structures. When I woke up, I had no idea of how to do any of that. I had no concept of how to do it. All I knew was that if I stayed in my hometown, I would just feel like a failure. And I would feel like I would be confronted every day with things that I didn't remember, and I would just feel purposeless and rudderless. And so I convinced everybody I was okay. And I was 28. My parents have talked about this a lot and wished that they would have kept me at home. But I was 28. There's the assumption of competence when you're 28. If I was 18 and this happened, my parents would have kept me home.
Well, there's two threads to go there. I first want to remind folks that we're talking with David Stewart McLean on Focus. He writes about his experience with severe amnesia in his book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a new book from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. If you have a question or a comment, call us at 1-800-222-9455. You can email your question at will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You write about, being back home and meeting people who know you, and you may have an inkling of who they are, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And one of them is your girlfriend.
Yeah.
And that has, and that's really, has to be one of the most difficult things that, that happened to you.
Yeah, I think one of the things about waking up to a life already in progress is you don't know the debts, the emotional debts and the emotional credits that you have. And for me at the time, ever since I was told I was a drug dealer, a drug user, like, I felt guilty. And so when I see Anne, all I can feel is this overwhelming guilt. And she couldn't have been a more wonderful, sweet person, but I couldn't help but feel guilty around her. And finally, I broke up with her, even though she was the only one of my friends who came to visit me to make sure I was okay.
You didn't think that you wanted to try to rebuild?
I didn't know. I didn't know what I owed her. I didn't know, like, where the relationship was. And since I didn't remember her, I felt like I was doing something awful to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like a terrible person to have forgotten someone I loved. And it was better for both of us if the relationship ended. At least that's what I thought at the time.
And we should note that by now, as you relate in the book, you met somebody new and married.
Yeah.
And I believe Anne has as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Are the two of you still friends?
Yeah. I mean, we talk every once in a while. That's not her real name. She asked me to change her name. She's having a great life. Like, we both had kids the same year, she's really having a great life.
But you talked about emotional debts, and I guess what came to mind to me is that a difficulty in amnesia, in meeting people who you do not remember well, is not only do you not know them, you don't know what they know about you, and you may not know that thing about you that they know about you.
Yeah.
And one thing that I gather throughout the book is that you had something of a reputation of being a prankster and someone who needed to be the center of attention. And coming out of amnesia, you did not know that.
No.
And apparently, I don't know if you felt any particular need at that stage in life with the amnesia to be a prankster or the center of attention. But that's how people saw you, so that when you send out an email to your friends telling them what had happened, they had difficulty believing it.
Yeah. One of my professors immediately emailed back, and he said, "I'm sorry that this happened to you. In coincidentally, I fell down the stairs this morning and bonked my head, and now I have superpowers, and I've been flying around the living room all day. Have fun, David." Like, he was now he feels terrible about it. But, like, at the time, that was a legitimate response from any of my friends.
How much you had to deal with that? And one thing I gathered, at least the way that you were taking it in, is you were finding out these things about yourself that made you seem like not that nice a person.
Yeah.
At least the way that you interpreted it.
Yeah.
And maybe the larger sense at the end of the day was that there were good and bad aspects to that part of your personality.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to figure that out?
I think I'm still figuring that out. I think it's hard. I think it's hard when, hallucinations are absurd, right? They're not objective reality. But there's a residue that a hallucination can leave on your life. And there's a sort of truth to a hallucination, too. And all of my hallucinations were about how I was failing my loved ones, I was failing my soul, I was inadequate. I woke up feeling like I needed to work and I needed to become a better person. I woke up and I was searching for people who would say something bad about me, because it would confirm what I already knew from my hallucination.
You have an excerpt from the book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, to read for us. And is this? I understand this is from the early part of the book?
Yeah, very early part of the book that I can read. This is just at the very moment where I wake up. I was standing when I came to, not lying down. And it wasn't a gradual waking process. It was darkness, 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 then snap, me, now awake. It was hot. My thin shirt clung to my back and shoulders, and my underwear was bunched into a sweaty wad. The heat left the ground in wavy lines, and the air was tinged blue with diesel exhaust. A woman in a burqa pushed past me. A small man in a ragged red vest ducked around me. He was hunched under the massive steel trunk on his back. The corner of the trunk nicked my shoulder as he maneuvered by. I was in the center of the crowd, half surging for the train, half surging for the exit. I stood still. I had no idea who I was. This fact didn't panic me at first. I didn't know enough to panic. In front of me was a train, a heaving, shuddering train. Its engine, half submerged in smoke, painted a deep red. It blasted its horns, then clanked and panted into motion. People waved to me from open windows as the train shook itself free of the station. I waved back and noticed the whiteness of my arm, covered in hairs the color of straw. I tracked the train's slow-motion progress. As I choked on the bursts of blue exhaust and stared at the receding last car, I wondered if I should have been on that train. I checked my front pockets for a ticket. Nothing. Not even a passport. Now I began to worry. I had lost my passport. I was in a train station in a foreign country without my passport. Then I realized that I couldn't even think of what name would have been on a passport, if I had one, or what foreign country I was currently in. This is when I panicked. A man in a small nearby stall clanked a pan against a propane burner. He banged and scraped a spatula against the pan that clanged against the metal burner. The sound was impossibly loud, louder than the train had been. I wanted to ask the man for help. I didn't want the man to know I needed help. I wanted him to stop banging the pan. I could feel a heavy absence in my brain, like a static cloud. I couldn't remember anything past waking up. There was a thick mass of nothing up there. My muscles were taut, caught in a constant flinch, waiting for someone, anyone, to punch me. I was alone, alone with no idea how far I was from anyone who knew me. I was alone and empty and terrified. I wiped my face with both palms. I blacked out.
Well, that's an amazing passage, David, from your book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me. And it seems, I don't know if ironic is the right word, but you must have spent a lot of effort remembering everything about about your dealing with amnesia.
Yeah, I mean, that's the core irony at the center of a book subtitled a Memoir of Amnesia is you're writing about an absence. You're writing about a sort of dealing with that absence. You're writing about a hole that you don't know how deep it goes. But I will say, like, one of the things, the best metaphor I can think about in terms of waking up is, early photography daguerreotypes. They would coat a copper plate with chemicals and then expose that chemical-coated plate to light, and the image would sear onto that plate. And that's sort of what my brain was at that moment. It was like my brain was just coated in chemicals, and when I woke up, I remember that. It seared into me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that better than anything. And that's a weird thing to have in my life, but it is. I remember that train station. I remember what I was wearing. I remember the shoes I was wearing. I remember standing there on that platform.
Was that the case for a lot of incidents as you sat down and tried to recall what had happened to you since you came to yourself on that train platform in 2002? Were you able to recall all the many things that happened to you that way?
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, what had happened over those years was I had denied that it happened to me. I had really done a really good job of not really talking to anybody about that it happened to me, except for a few people, and just holding it really, really tight. And when I did tell people about it, I would joke about it. And so the first few passes of writing about this, it was all jokey. It was all like a hilarious trip that happened in India.
So this was going to be sort of like a My Journey Through Amnesia as written by Bob Hope or something.
Right, totally, like this romp. And then I realized, like, trying to be clever is a way of asserting your control over it. Like, I wanted to be smarter than my pain. And so that's what I tried to do. I tried to be clever and smart and, like, always be in control, because I never wanted to admit that I was out of control, and I wanted to, that there's a pain that still exists in me that I don't have full control of.
Well, there's one thing that I found remarkable about your book, David, is that you seem to be a willingness to expose yourself not succeeding at things throughout, you know, a good deal of the book until, you know, essentially you get better.
Yeah.
And even though you thought you were succeeding or you thought you were doing the right thing, it just wasn't working, and you were willing to put that down on the page.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's essential. I think complicity and failure are things that we don't write enough about, and we don't read enough about. And I think, like, it's those things that our own personal narrative that we advertise to the world doesn't include. And to really come into contact with that, in which I was sort of force-fed my failure. Like, to be able to write this book, I had to go into that place and really reckon with all of the things that I did wrong.
Well, it's time for our short break on Focus, and when we come back, we'll talk more with David Stewart McLean about his experience with amnesia and about the drug that caused it. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WYLL.
On the next Fresh Air, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She grew up in a drug-ravaged South Bronx neighborhood. She says the tragedy she saw there helped her understand that as a judge,
the people who came before me as defendants were human beings with good and potentially very bad things within them.
Her memoir is out in paperback. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, three blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House Catering can tailor a menu and price for events from corporate box lunches to weddings, business meetings, and other special events. More information is available at 365-8004.
We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today is David Stewart McLean, who writes about coming back from amnesia in his book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a memoir of amnesia. If you're in the Chicago area this week, you can catch one of David's bookstore readings. One of them is tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the bookstall at Chestnut Court in Winnetka. That's the official book launching. Other is on Thursday, the 16th at 7 p.m. at the bookseller in the 4700 block of North Lincoln in Chicago. And there's more information on David Stewart McLean's website, davidstewartmclean.com. There's a link to that at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Again, if you have a question for David or a comment about amnesia, maybe as experienced by you or someone you know, call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. David, let's talk a little bit about the drug that caused this amnesia. You do spend some time actually writing both about malaria and about Larium. That's the brand name of the drug that you reacted so badly to. What happened? What does this drug do?
So Larium, or the generic name is Mefloquine, was developed in 1971. It was first found in 1969, but then developed, tested for its anti-malarial properties in 1971 when the Walter Reed Institute of Research was testing 200,000 different compounds to fight malaria, because troops from Vietnam were coming back infected with malaria even though they were taking chloroquine. So chloroquine-resistant malaria started to rear its head. And so there needed to be another drug. And so they tested this drug, found it, and found that it worked. And so they, in this weird, it's a public-private venture. This is the first one ever in regards to a drug. So the U.S. military and Hoffman LaRoche worked together to develop this drug. And really, when it first came out, it was a miracle drug. And to understand how much of a miracle it was, you got to understand that, like, Malaria is a parasite that has been sort of messing with the human species for 500,000 years. Like, it's bigger than the moon in some ways. And so in 1971, we had this idea that we were going to defeat malaria. To defeat malaria is as big of an accomplishment as walking on the moon. And so we were really trying to defeat malaria. And so when these side effects started showing up, in my charitable days, I would say the excitement that we had finally found a drug that took care of malaria overrode our logic. And we didn't sort of take these side effects seriously. Mostly, you know, because they were people who were traveling. They were people who were already in stressful situations. They were kids in the military who were complaining about this stuff. And so people didn't take these side effects seriously. And still, like, we're still having problems taking it seriously. CBS News just did a thing on malarium where the military is still prescribing this, even though they said they stopped in 2009, stopped using it as their leading anti-malarial agent in 2009. And the side effects on this, just this year, the FDA put on a black box warning onto mefloquine, saying that some of these side effects can become permanent. And some of the side effects involve, like, vestibular problems, where constant feelings of vertigo, muscle tremors. It's no good.
And I'm looking at the New York Times article from last July, reporting on the FDA's decision to put the black box warning on the larium label. And I was struck to find that Roche, which first made the drug, no longer sells it in the U.S. If you get it in the U.S., it's a generic version.
Yeah.
From what you know, and I don't know how much you've gone into the history of malaria medications. Are there other new medications out there besides larium and its equivalent drugs that are able to combat malaria without having these side effects, or at least not as bad?
Absolutely. I mean, right now the drug of choice is Malarone. And the thing about why someone would take larium, I would actually sort of like to say this. The thing about why someone would take larium is if you're in an area that has cerebral malaria, which can kill you in 48 hours, I would take larium. I would take larium again.
Knowing that it might do the same thing to you again.
If I was in an area that had it, and that's a very small area of the world.
Mm-hmm. That had the cerebral malaria or had the drug?
That has cerebral malaria.
And that's where we're going into the whole thing about the danger of malaria, is that it can get through the blood-brain barrier.
Right. The drug, mefloquine, gets through the blood-brain barrier and pools in the brain for some people.
Now, I'm sorry, does malaria do that?
No.
Okay.
No. Oh, in cerebral malaria, yes.
Ah.
And that's sort of, I can never remember the Latinate name, sorry.
Okay, but
two different kinds of malaria, and one can kill you in 48 hours. If you're traveling to an area with that kind of malaria and it's chloroquine resistant, it totally makes sense to take larium. I would probably take Malarone before larium any day, but the standard doxycycline or chloroquine isn't going to cut it in those areas.
Let's go ahead and take another caller. Line 1, Paul in Champaign County is with us. Paul, good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, I don't want to foment any further hysteria about vaccinations, but this is a different category, this prophylactic use. You're just sort of getting at the problems with this one drug, and I'm wondering whether you looked into some of the other instances where people had problems with it, and I'm thinking of the U.S. military in South Asia. They gave that out very liberally, and I don't know if you catalog the list of things that can happen from it, but psychotic breaks and some of that stuff has been pointed at because of that. So did you
happen
to look at
it? David, you did write on that, didn't you? I mean, this is a drug that was developed by the Army, so they have their hands on it.
Yeah, and I can say that, like, when I look at the incredible, like, skyrocketing rates of suicide, the USA Today just 2 days ago talked about the skyrocketing. I mean, like, in 2009, it was like 46 people per 100,000 of recent vets, not active duty, recent vets. And that was in 2009, and in 2011, it was 80 per 100,000. And these people were on a drug whose side effect was suicide. And I want to also emphasize that, like, larium combined with alcohol is possibly the worst thing you could do. And it's difficult. It's difficult because in some ways, that's what you do. Especially when you feel off kilter, when you feel like you want to control your brain chemistry and what you're feeling. That's what I did. I drank a lot.
You talk about in the book of drinking a lot and also smoking a lot. I don't know if you did that before the larium incident.
Yeah. Never had a cigarette in my life. But I will say, getting back to the military thing, I think the military is going to be wrestling with this for a long time. Dr. Remington Nevin, who was an Army officer and an epidemiologist with the Army, has testified before Congress that he's afraid that this is the Agent Orange of this generation.
And could this be something, a key besides anything else going on, could this be a big factor, do you think, in the military suicide rate or the veteran suicide rate at this time?
That's just speculation on my part. I have no hard data to point at that. All I can say is, when I saw that rate, the first thing I thought of was larium.
I think you do write about how the military has been, and they may have changed more recently, but they had perhaps because of faulting testing of the drug, been prescribing too much larium for people, and also giving it to people in areas where really there is no malaria threat.
Yeah, and also one of the first things you're supposed to do is, if you start to experience any of the initial symptoms, if you experience nausea, if you experience any sort of feelings of confusion or paranoia, you're supposed to stop taking the drug immediately. And that's really difficult in the military, to go to your superior officer and say, I'm not feeling well, when part of what you're doing is swallowing the self in order to achieve the greater goal.
Mm-hmm.
So people are told to man up and take the drug.
And, Paul, thank you very much for bringing this subject up. As far as your own case, did you feel in the onset any bad reaction coming on? And that really goes on to really a second part of my question there is, was that experience erased by the amnesia?
That experience was erased by the amnesia. I don't remember arriving in India. I don't remember any of that.
Even now, 12 years later, you haven't been able to recover that part of your memory.
Right. But it's also, I will say this, like, it's also 12 years ago. If I asked you what you were doing in October 12 years ago, I wonder how well would you do?
I don't know.
Yeah, see, it's sort of difficult to sort of talk about that, what you don't know at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like a perpetual anxiety system.
But if, for instance, if it had involved, say, going to an airport, and I don't fly that often, so I remember those things,
yeah,
and I could not tell you anything about the airport at all, then I would be a little concerned.
Right. What I can do is I have both my parents, who are incredible taker downs of notes, and I also have my diaries at that time, and so I was throwing up a lot. My mom made a spreadsheet of my symptoms early on because I was throwing up all the time. At one point, I was confused, and I don't remember this at all, but supposedly I was confused, and I walked into a Christian church in Hyderabad and talked to the priest and told him that I didn't know who I was. And then, supposedly, a couple minutes later, I was fine, and my friend was called, and he took me home, and nobody, you know, they just thought I was being weird, and didn't really know what was coming.
And something else related to that, you write in the book of when you return to India to complete your studies there, you run into some boys.
Yeah.
They're driving by, and they're awfully young to be driving, but they're driving, and they recognize you.
Yeah.
And you have no idea who they are.
Yeah.
Or how you, or what sort of situation would have caused you to meet them.
Yeah. So I, on October 16th, the day before I woke up, I left my flat in Secunderabad, in Tarnaka, where I was living, and which is sort of the sister city to Hyderabad. It's St. Paul, Minneapolis, sort of. I left my flat with the door open, computer on, music on, and just left at 4 p.m. that day. And we know that because the watchman of the house, of the apartment building that I was staying in, watched me go and went and told someone about it, that it looked like I had been drinking, I was stumbling. And so between 4 p.m. and whenever I was found on the train station, I have no idea what happened during that time.
And that was how long a period of time?
That's probably 4 o'clock until probably 10 the next morning. So over 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just lost. And so there are little glimpses I have of that night. Like one is I remember the sound of monkeys. But who knows if that's even accurate. But I walked from my apartment to the train station, and it took me over 12 hours, and it was about 7 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have no idea what happened between there.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions and comments for David McLean. He is the author of The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, A Memoir of Amnesia. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL, our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm wondering, you've written this book. At what point did you decide that this is something you needed to write about?
I was finishing my PhD at the University of Houston in fiction, and I just noticed that my fiction was, I kept having recurring characters who had lost time in their lives, either through prison sentences or disease or whatever, and I kept having these characters, and I kept having these massive time jumps in my fiction. And it just felt artificial, and it felt small.
You were doing it? I mean, these were the ideas that were coming to you, but they didn't seem right.
Right. I was writing about it, but in some ways I wasn't writing the thing. I was writing around the thing.
Now, when you went back, you know, when you returned to finish your studies, that produced a novel.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that novel?
It's terrible. it's very scatological. It's very absurd.
Did you ever send it out?
I did. Yeah, and everyone who every agent wrote back, and they were just like, I don't know who to like in this. It all feels so distant. And that's sort of how I was. That's how I was treating my emotional life. Like everything was wrapped up in cellophane.
So how did you get to the point of actually writing about your own experiences?
You know, I finally found a good therapist. It's silly that it takes that, but it really was. And I had some really remarkably bad therapists. While I was recovering.
Were they helpful at all, or just unhelpful and or not helpful enough?
They were helpful in some. Like, there's one in the book who is who started to be helpful, and because she seemed to be helpful, I opened up to her, and then she turned out to be crazy. And that was actually kind of helpful, because it let me know that I could recognize what crazy was.
And that sounds like also the same woman who said what seemed like one of the most frank and to the point summations of where you were at one point, where you had given her this just really creative discussion of something connected to your condition, and she just set out with that and said, "Well, that's not really to the point of your condition at all. You're dancing around it."
And that was amazing, and it was like, it was one of those things where she said, "You're not going to outsmart your pain," and it was just sort of like, "Oh." I really thought I could be smarter than suffering. And so I opened up to her, and I told her about these banal mares I was having.
And you should talk a little more about the banal mares.
Yeah, so I would have these dreams where I would wake up in the dream as a convenience store worker or a tax attorney or what have you, and I would... In the convenience store worker dream, I woke up and I had been hit by the glass door on the cooler, and I had woke up among, like, the Dr. Pepper that I was stocking. And this woman came up and helped me up, and she said, "It's okay, honey. I'll take care of you." And she puts me into the office of the convenience store. And in the convenience store office were, like, all of these monitors, some watching the pumps, some watching the inside of my parents' house, and it was just these sort of like incredibly boring dreams, like clock watching dreams, and they were terrifying to me. There was something I was missing. There was something that was empty, and I told this therapist this story, and how sad I was. Be missing so much. And she said, "Well, you know, convenience store workers provide a very important function in the universe." And I wasn't sure. At that point, when she said that, I wasn't sure if she was actually going to say something like some Marxist theology about the worker. And I was like, "I know, I've had those jobs. I've done those jobs.
But that's not what she was getting at.
And that's not what she was getting at. What she said instead was, convenience store workers are the reincarnated souls of people who died in the Holocaust, and they need the mundanity of those jobs to make up for what happened to them in their previous life.
So that pretty much was the end of your relationship with that therapist.
Yeah.
The therapist that worked for you ultimately, how did that lead to writing about this and really taking this on as a writer?
One of the things that she did really well, and she works in Texas, she's wonderful, was to really encourage me to, each week I would come in and I would tell this story. And there's something about that that detoxified the story for me. I was no longer hiding it. I had a place every week where I could tell the story again, and it really detoxified the memories for me. I still can get a little teary when I talk about it, but it's no longer full on panic attack, fall down. The rest of the day is canceled, which it was for a while.
Well, we're getting to the last few minutes of the program. You've been in this situation where your life and career was really waylaid by this drug. Now that hopefully you're getting back on your feet, you've certainly produced a fascinating book on the subject. What do you want to do now?
I really want to raise awareness of this drug. I really want other people who have suffered these sort of things, to now know that they're not crazy. That they're not alone, that this happened, and that's the most important thing to me right now.
Do you still see yourself as a writer as well?
Absolutely, and a teacher. I love my students.
Where are you teaching?
I teach at University of Chicago and Columbia College, and I have phenomenal students, and they're really great, and they teach me every single day.
Well, David Stewart McLean, thank you for coming on Focus today to talk about your experience battling amnesia and your book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Thank you, Jim.
And you can find out more about David at his website, davidstewartmclean.com. You'll find a link to it at our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. Thanks to everyone who called or emailed emailed questions, and any apologies to anybody who didn't make it to the air today. We invite you to continue the discussion on today's program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today. Tomorrow on Focus, why aren't there more female governors in the United States? And why has Illinois only had two major party nominees for governor who were women? We'll look at that question tomorrow with Professor Kelly Dittmar from the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University and Tom Kasich, political reporter for the News Gazette. That's on tomorrow's program. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10. There's a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit of Illinois, offering financial products and services specifically for the agriculture industry.